places. Thankfully, we didn't get any of that. We're studying apologetics. We've looked at different things that help explain why we believe that the Bible is the truth. And this morning, we're going to look at dinosaurs and whether or not dinosaurs and people live together. Who can tell me about the movie Jurassic Park? You ever seen it? Famous dinosaur movie. What does Jurassic mean anyway? What's that? Old, yeah, old. That's a period of history that some claim was about 6,500? Thousand? Million years ago. That's when the Jurassic period ended, so they say, and that all the dinosaurs became extinct at the end of the Jurassic period that they believe existed. But there is an abundance of evidence that shows dinosaurs have existed up until recent times, and people have seen and interacted with them. And we're going to look at some of that evidence this morning, not all of it. And we may not get through all of this, but we'll do what we can. So the question is, did dinosaurs and people ever live together? And when you look at the Bible and read what the Bible says, it's pretty obvious that they did or they would have. What does the creation account tell us about all living things? When were they created? In the first 6 days. Everything was made in the first 6 days. That's what Genesis tells us. So that being true, we would expect that dinosaurs would have been right there with people. So evidence, what evidence is there for their coexistence outside of the Bible? That's what we're looking at this morning. We believe the Bible. Not everybody believes the Bible, but if you don't have a Bible and you do have the evidence, then you've got something that shows you that what the Bible says is true, even if you don't have it. And we're going to start with legends. We call them legends. They're legends about lizard-like beasts. What were they called back in the day? Dragons. Where are there dragon legends in the world? Abounding in the histories of many peoples are accounts of lizard-like beasts. We might refer to them as legends, but what they have are actually accounts. They believe they're history. They're written as though they're history. The existence of such creatures has been recorded by explorers, historians, scholars, kings, and saints. Dragons, that was the word. It wasn't until 1841 that a fellow by the name of Richard Owen coined the word or the phrase terrible lizards, dinosaurs. That's what dinosaur means, terrible lizard. So they found some huge bones, believed now it was either an iguanodon or an edmontosaurus. A couple of different accounts vary in that, but just huge bones that they knew didn't believe anything that was alive that they knew of at that point. And so they said, well, this must be the bones of a huge, terrible lizard. And so this guy, Richard Owen, came up with that word. Before we knew about dinosaurs, people would have used the word dragons. You ever see the word dragon in the Bible? It's in there. We even sing it in one of our songs, Hallelujah, Praise Jehovah. What's that? Yes, it's in the Revelation, it's in the Psalms, Leviathan, a dragon, different words in Hebrew and Greek. But ancient peoples who spoke English would have called them dragons. Historical accounts of dragons are abundant all over the world. Who has accounts of dragons? Who would you guess, just before I put any of these names up here? China, oh yeah, Chinese, they're famous for them. They have kites, really cool, huge kites that fly in the air. They're of dragons. Any other countries you can think of? Might be surprised when you see the list. China, of course, is the one we think of the most. And then Japan and Nepal. Nepal is right next door to China. The Pacific Islands, still in Asia. Australia. Australia? You ever heard of dragons in Australia? They have accounts of dragon-like creatures down there. African tribes have accounts of dragon-like creatures. North American Indian, whoa, we're coming way across now. North American Indian tribes, a lot of them have accounts of interactions with dragon-like creatures. South American cultures. So how many continents have we covered so far? There's Asia, we got Africa, we got South America, we got North America. I don't remember, is Australia its own continent? It ought to be. Just yeah, okay. So there's a whole different. Now, Egypt is part of Africa. Don't normally think of it like that, though, do we? And Ethiopia, right down below Egypt. Persia. Wait a minute. Which way are we going to get to Persia from Egypt and Ethiopia? We're going back to the east again, over towards Eurasia. India has dragon accounts. Russia. The Russians don't want to be left out. And then Europe, more specifically, England, France, Ireland, Switzerland, Scandinavia, Germany, Italy, Greece. All of these countries or areas have accounts, and some of them multiple accounts of dragons. And not finding simply their bones, but interacting with the live creatures. The Unktehi, that's how I'll pronounce that word. This is depicted. How well can you see that? Oh, that's pretty good. This is a creature depicted on the Agawa Rock at, here we go, Mishapezu. That almost sounds like I'm making it up, but that's a real place. That's a real word. In Lake Superior Provincial Park, Ontario, Canada, it was known to the Ojibwa people as well as the Sioux of the Northern Plains, the Unktehi. Henry Rose Schoolcraft, he was a geologist and he was an Indian agent. He wrote extensively about the Sioux Indians and recorded images as well as accounts of the creatures. And these are three, or two rather, the two at the top are drawings that he has preserved for us. The two drawings to the left were reproduced about 1850 from pictures made by Sioux Indians on birch bark. By the way, do you remember when the word dinosaur was coined? 1841. So 1841, the word dinosaur is coined. In 1850, about that time, this Indian agent is recording pictures, images that the native tribes have drawn of creatures they had interactions with. And then you see the drawing of the creature below that. That's an ankylosaurus. And their drawings look very familiar to that. And when we look at a modern depiction of an ankylosaurus, we're doing that from the standpoint of fossils that we found. We just find the bones and we think we know how they walked and stood and crawled, whatever. But their representation's a little bit different. So maybe they knew more about it than we did. There is a picture of an ankylosaurus taken at the Boston Zoo, I think. This is a fanciful picture, but probably a very accurate picture. I say very accurate because we also have, well, wait a minute here. Was the Yangtze, here's the question, was the Yangtze an ankylosaurus? How did both the Ojibwa and the Sioux make such an accurate drawings, or make such accurate drawings if they had not seen it? So we got two Indian tribes drawing pictures of this creature that looks like something we know used to exist. It looks like an ankylosaurus. How did they know to draw those images? And then over in Alberta, Canada, not that far from Ontario, this basically mummified fossil was found of an ankylosaurus. And they rave about this. And one of the things I just put this in this morning. I thought about making another place for some text and pulling a quote out of the article that was written about this, because it says, it looks as if it died in water and was carried by a river out to sea and sank to the bottom and then buried over with silt, and that's how it became a fossil. Is there another option? Maybe it was buried in Noah's flood. Anyway, that's from Canada. The Anasazi Indians left depictions of creatures, and the carving at the left is found at the Kachina Bridge in the National Bridge Monument of Utah. There are two pictures of it there. Also found in the area is a picture of an ibex and one that resembles a woolly mammoth, which tells us, okay, they saw these animals and they drew pictures of them. That's what you do. We still do that today. The remains of both of these animals have been found in that region. though the animals themselves have not been present for many years. Ibexes used to be there. They saw them. They drew them. Mammoths used to be there. They saw them. They drew them. But what about this creature? Now, I've been told, there's an account I read, if I'd go back and find it again. Some of these things, when you're doing your research, you see a lot of stuff, and you pick and choose which you're going to save. And sometimes you go back and you think, oh, I should have saved that one. But there's an account of somebody talking to one of the rangers at that place, and they're asking, well, what's that? Well, that's a picture of an ibex. Well, that's a picture of a mammoth. Well, what's that down there? It looks like a dinosaur. Well, we don't know what that is. What does that look like? Looks like an apatosaurus. Or a Diplodocus, a Brachiosaurus, a large sauropod dinosaur. I don't know why they couldn't say it looks like a sauropod dinosaur. There it is. That's what it looks like. And those Indians drew it. How did they know to draw that? And why did they draw it along with the same animals that we know they must have seen in that area? The remains of sauropods are also found in this area, just like the remains of ibex and mammoths. And so evidence looks like these people saw these things and they drew pictures of them. More Native American dinosaur drawings. This is a petroglyph. It was discovered in 2012 in New Mexico near Hidden Mountain, just outside of Los Lunas. It is on an isolated, nearly inaccessible ledge near a very clear deer petroglyph. What's that look like to you? Looks like a dinosaur to me. And it's interesting that it's on a nearly inaccessible ledge, because if you were going to fake something, go up there and try to fake something, which there are ways to test these things to see how old they are, but if you were going to fake it, would you put it in some place nearly inaccessible? Or would you put it someplace where it would likely be found? I don't know. But somebody made it a long time ago. So was this ancient artist drawing a Saurolophus? That's an actual dinosaur. And it sure looks like that. Is that what they were drawing? Because they saw one? Who etched into the wall of the Grand Canyon what appears to be an image of an Edmontosaurus? This was discovered by Samuel Hubbard. He was an evolutionist in the late 1800s. And how did the artist reproduce the image so accurately? Now take a look at that chalk outline. If you wanted to imagine a fanciful creature that would be fantastic and get people's attention, would you draw that? That looks like his head's made out of an old sock or something, just kind of drooping over. But what if they had seen the actual animal and they were just drawing what they saw? That would make perfect sense. And that's what they drew. Looks like an Edmontosaurus. And there are fossilized remains of these creatures in that very area. So the evidence is they saw these animals alive and they drew pictures of them, etched them in the rocks. What did Hubbard have to say about this? Remember, this is a guy that found it, and he's an evolutionist. But he said, the fact that some prehistoric man made a pictograph of a dinosaur on the walls of this canyon upsets completely all the theories regarding the antiquity of man. Facts are stubborn and immutable things. If theories do not square with the facts, then the theories must change. The facts remain. Pretty objective statement. This is from, there's the reference to it. Doheny E. L. Discoveries relating to the prehistoric man by the Doheny Scientific Expedition in the Havasupai Canyon, northern Arizona. So we're talking about people who should know what they're doing, what they're talking about, finding these things and documenting them and making commentary on them, saying, yeah, this is real. Somebody drew that. Dino pottery from native tribes here in North America, that is. This artifact was left by the Mississippian culture. This is 800 to 1500 A.D. How long ago was 1500 A.D.? Not that long. We're talking 600-700 years back to the dates represented here, and they made this pottery artifact. What's that look like to you? A puppy? No. That looks like a dinosaur to me. It looks like another sauropod. What animal could this piece of art represent if not a sauropod dino? That's the question. You find these things and you look at it and you go, well, that looks like a dinosaur. Oh, by the way, that swirl, that indicates water. And it seems like everything we know about the sauropods was that they lived near or around or in water, which makes perfect sense. If you've got that much of a mass to carry around, if you can find water to get in, wade around, and eat the nice green stuff that would grow in water. And by the way, we'll read later of what I believe is a sauropod dinosaur in the Bible, in the book of Job, and that's what Job seems to be describing, or what God seems to be describing to Job, is a large animal like this one that would have lived in the water. Here's another artistic depiction on some pottery from the Mississippi Caddo Indians around 1200 A.D. And we're not talking that far back. This is pretty recent as we're talking about historical time, especially if some are claiming, well, there was the Jurassic period that was 65 million years ago. Well, really? Okay, well, looks like we're seeing these things much later than the Jurassic period of 65 million years ago. Doesn't that look like a dinosaur fashioned into the handle? That's what it looks like to me. I don't know what else that would be if it's not a dinosaur. It's not simply a snake because it's got a body connected to the snake-like neck with the head. It sure looks like a dinosaur to me, just like that other piece we just looked at. How did early Native Americans know how to accurately depict such animals if they had not seen them? That's the question. Where would this come from? Simply their imaginations? Well, it's interesting that if they would have imagined this, why are the same things imagined by peoples and cultures all over the world who also depicted these animals? From the Illini Indians of Illinois. Illini, Illinois, makes you wonder if maybe that's where Illinois got their name, from the Illini Indians. These native people tell the legend of Piassa, meaning bird that devours man. Lived in a cave and killed many people. Piassa was supposedly killed by a young man with a bow and arrow after the creature killed his family. So this is from Illinois. And then there's the Pima Indians of southern Arizona. There's a report from the Spanish explorer Captain Juan Mateo Manji with the Jesuits of Eusebio, or the Jesuits Eusebio Francisco Quino and Adamo Gil. They were exploring. So what we've got some documented stuff, if you will, from people who were sent out officially to do some exploring, to do some mapping, to do research, to spy out the land, so to speak, just like Joshua sent spies into Canaan. And here we've got representatives of the Spanish government documenting these stories, these accounts. It says the Pima people gave accounts of two great flying monsters that ate people, just like the Illini Indians had that story from Illinois. One was asphyxiated when the Indians built a fire at the mouth of its cave, and the other was killed in a similar fashion after it inhabited a pueblo. You seen pueblos? It looks like the kind of place that a flying monster would want to get to. The Yaqui Indians of southern Arizona also have a similar account. So the Pima Indians, the Yaqui Indians, the Illini Indians, they have accounts of these large flying creatures that were very dangerous to people. So did they see a Quetzalcoatlus, the largest pterosaur? Are similar accounts and depictions, descriptions, nothing more than mere coincidence. And there you can see the huge size of what this creature would look. Could you imagine? You're out fishing. Shadow comes over top. One of these things lands next to you, grabs your bait can, grabs you. These things were huge. We know they existed. We found their remains. And we found their remains in the same places where these native tribes were drawing their pictures. These are some figurines discovered in 1945 by Valdemar Jules Rude in Acambaro, Mexico. Of the 33,000 figurines, about 2,600 dinosaur-like creatures have been fashioned by somebody in the past. So there's all these figurines. Somebody was taking the clay, pulled the clay out of the ground, fashioned all kinds of different figurines, all kinds, 33,000 they found so far, no telling how many were actually made, but they found 33,000, and of those 33,000, 2,600 of them look like dinosaurs. Attempts to discredit their authenticity have failed. So the attempts to say these are fake, somebody made these recently and are trying to use these to make us think people saw dinosaurs, we'll test these, we'll investigate these, and we'll show you that they're fake. And they couldn't do it. 2,600 of them. This is one of those animals. It says, dermal spines and tails were held aloft, details not known to modern science until late in the 20th century. I didn't find a picture of it, but I used to have a coloring book when I was a kid. It had a brontosaurus, which there's actually no brontosaurus. They found out they took the wrong head, put it on the wrong body, and called it the brontosaurus, and now there's no brontosaurus. Anyway, it was supposed to be a brontosaurus at the time. And it was a big hulking thing, and the tail just kind of fell down off the backside and drug along the ground. And now they've discovered that's not the way they actually held their tails. And this is a more accurate description. Well, how did this guy, this was discovered in the late 20th century, I mean the 1945, that's when these were discovered. How did whoever fashioned this know to depict What's that look like? That looks like a dinosaur. Could be a stegosaurus, or it could be a sauropod with dermal spines, because we didn't know about the dermal spines and the aloft tail until about the mid-90s. Now, how did they know to make this creature and make it so anatomically accurate and accurate in the way it moved? And they did. Here's some ceremonial burial stones from the Nazca culture down in Peru. And these are dated to about 100 BC to 800 AD. Once again, very recent, really, when you're looking at the historical line. And they have so many dinosaurs depicted in them. How many dinosaurs can you count there? There's a guy, he looks like he's sitting on top of that sauropod, spearing it in the neck, trying to kill it. And here are some others. It's not quite as clear, but that's a sauropod dinosaur. And more dermal spines. So we've got the Acambara figurines with dermal spines that we didn't know they had. And now we've got these Nazca stones with the dermal spines we didn't know they had. How did they know to put those on there unless they saw them? And man, there's a bunch of them on here. There are over 11,000 such stones. Extant's just a word that means they still exist. You can go where they are and you can look at them yourself. They exist and they are somewhere. That's all extant means. And this one pictures a wide variety of dinosaurs, but that's what they put on there. St. George. How many of you have heard of St. George killing the dragon? St. George kills the dragon. Nearly all ancient depictions show the dragon this size or smaller. Now, there are some more modern depictions of St. George killing the dragon, and the dragon's a great, big, huge, fearsome-looking beast. But what does this thing look like? If you were just fantasizing, if you were creating from your mind a dragon, is this what you would create? Or would you make something much larger and much scarier and much higher? And when you go back to the ancient depictions of St. George killing the dragon, this is the kind of thing you see. Much smaller beast. Early depictions beginning in the 11th century are similar to this guy. This is a Nothosaurus, and it looks very much like the creature depicted in that stonework there. So is that what St. George killed? And there's the comparative size of a Nothosaurus. And if you take a look back again at that's about right, isn't it? If that's what he killed, that's a pretty accurate depiction. They didn't fantasize something that was huge and fire-breathing and menacing. They fantasized something that actually lived in the area where it was supposedly killed. Looks about right. English dragons. What kind of an accent would an English dragon have? To the right is a picture of the tomb of Bishop Richard Bell. His body was buried in the floor of Carlisle Cathedral in 1496. When did Columbus sail? 1492. So we're talking the same time frame that Columbus came over to America trying to find the West Indies. That's about the same time poor old Bishop Bell died and was buried in the floor of Carlisle Cathedral. There are brass inlays bearing engravings of various known creatures such as a dog, a pig, a weasel, and so on. And in addition to these normal animals, however, are depictions of what appear to be two sauropods and another crocodilian-shaped dinosaur. And there they are. So you can go there. You can go to Carlisle Cathedral and you can look at the tomb of Bishop Bell and you can see these brass inlays for yourself. And you can see, well, there's all the regular animals that we would expect to be in there, but what are these? These are dinosaurs. And they're not set off differently and distinct as if these were something other than what they would have seen. They're just etched in there just like all the other animals are etched in there, which leads us to a conclusion that they saw these things and they just etched them in there like they etched all the other animals. What else would we conclude about that? And how did the engravers know how to accurately depict sauropods, both anatomically and according to their posture, which we've not understood until recently, again, about the mid-90s, to be with heads and tails held aloft and horizontally? That's how they were depicted on his tomb. We've got multiple British dragon legends, not just this one from Bishop Bell's tomb. Author Jacqueline Simpson mentions in her book, British Dragons, published in 1980, that over 70 villages in Great Britain have legends and traditions involving local dragons. So that's a lot of evidence when you think about it. 70 different villages have stories of ancient dragons. A lot of French chateaus in the Middle Ages, 1500s, are decorated with salamanders that breathed fire. Isn't that interesting? And there are a couple of the depictions. There are a bunch of them. And these carvings are abundant in the French chateaus. Salamanders look a lot like this guy. This is the Baryonyx, and his remains are found throughout Europe. So is this some kind of a coincidence that this animal's remains are found in that same area where carvings are made of this creature or something very much like it and put on the chateaus? And why in the world would they carve that and put it on the chateaus? Well, the thing is, they were supposedly fire-breathing, and you put this depiction on the chateau and it protected it from fire. That's the logic behind it. That's the story. That's the reasoning. Very interesting. From Mesopotamia, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey, that's the area of Mesopotamia, ancient Mesopotamia. This artifact is a jasper cylinder made from jasper, and it's a seal. It's from the Uruk period, about 3500 BC in Mesopotamia. It's currently housed at the Louvre in Paris. And again, note the striking similarity between the beast depicted and the artist's conception of an apatosaurus with his head and tail very much aloft. Are we to believe it's mere coincidence that the artist guessed right? It just doesn't seem plausible, doesn't seem logical that they would make such an ornate and official thing with the picture of an animal that they imagined. More dragons, and this time we're looking at dragons from Israel. What are these dinosaur-like creatures depicted on an ancient synagogue in El-Kanatir in what's now the Golan Heights? How did artists know? How did they know to make these creatures look like this? And isn't that an interesting picture? It looks like an adult, maybe something like a T-Rex. That big delta thing is the top of the head coming down to bite that horse, and then behind it looks like a young T-Rex. That, come on, Bobby, we'll get some breakfast. We'll eat this horse. Okay, Mom. And that looks like what's going on there. But this is on a synagogue. Why would they put this on a synagogue? Why would they make this depiction? And why does it look like animals that we know used to exist? Dragons figure prominently in Jewish scripture. The Leviathan that's mentioned in Job chapter 3 and verse 8, Psalm 104 verse 26, and Isaiah 27:1. And we'll take a look at the description a little more detail from Job, Lord willing, here in a little bit. And we've got the flying serpents of Isaiah chapter 14 verse 29 and 36. The behemoth from Job 40 in great detail, which we plan to look at, or I plan for us to look at. The great dragon of the Revelation, chapter 12 and verse 9. When you read the Revelation, the dragon is a very prominent figure, prominent character. Where did that come from? Because we think about dragons. Okay, dragons, that's Chinese, that's Japanese. Well, no, it's right there in this very Jewish book written by Jewish people. John was a Jew, and they had this idea of dragons. They knew about dragons. They knew about dinosaurs, I believe. And so it comes up to us in the book. Chinese dragons. China is proliferated with dragon legends. Is it simply a coincidence that China is also proliferated with dinosaur fossils? When you start doing research looking for pictures of fossils, you'll find so many of them come out of China. And there are some on the market that you can buy if you got the money. China's neighbor, Nepal. This is from the Monktanath Temple in Nepal. It boasts 108 dragon head fountains. Is it mere coincidence that this one looks just like a Ceratopsian dinosaur? You can see the picture of the fountain, and then you see the Triceratops. How did they get that so close if they hadn't seen one? This is in Cambodia. What's that look like to you? Looks to me like a Stegosaurus. Any 6-year-old would look at that and say, yeah, that's a Stegosaurus, because they know what a Stegosaurus looks like. How did they know to carve this on this temple in Cambodia? This piece of art is part of the 800-year-old Taprom Temple in Cambodia. So 800 years ago, somebody carved this dinosaur-looking creature. It's one of many others depicting monkeys, deer, buffalo, lizards, and parrots. So are these same circular reliefs carved in stone? And some of them have monkeys, some of them have parrots, some of them have deer and buffalo, lizards. And this one looks like a dinosaur. And it's not set off. It's not any different than the others. It's the same thing. And so looks to me like they saw it. And somebody carved a picture of what they saw, just like they carved a picture of those other animals. Why did the artisans place this carving with others as if it were normal to see it? That's the question. How could they have known what a stegosaur looked like unless they had seen a stegosaur? A lot of questions, and there's a lot of evidence like this all over the world. What have we seen so far? Ancient peoples, over thousands of years, from multiple cultures, on several continents, in varied mediums, that is, they etched pictures, they made pottery that looked like dinosaurs, they had statuary, they painted them, they engraved them, they carved them, and put it in their literature. All these ways to express communication or art they used, and they depicted for us dinosaurs. And they did it with accurate detail. All of this points to the fact that people and dinosaurs live together, just like the Bible would have us believe. Which conclusion makes more sense? Ancient peoples accidentally created accurate images of creatures long extinct, or they saw the creatures and they recreated what they saw? What do you think? Now, wait a minute, we're not done yet. Soft tissue inside a T-Rex fossil? ! How old would a T-Rex fossil be according to the idea of the Jurassic period? 65 million years old. That's how old it's supposed to be. They cracked open a T-Rex fossil. Paleontologist Mary Schweitzer did. They were surprised to find soft tissues inside the femur bone of a Montana T-Rex discovered in 2003. So they discovered the T-Rex fossil in 2003, and the bone was broken open. I believe it happened by accident. You wouldn't normally do that on purpose. And inside they discovered soft tissue. And this is from an MSNBC.com article. For more than a century, the study of dinosaurs has been limited to fossilized bones. Now, researchers have recovered 70 million-year-old soft tissue, including what may be blood vessels and cells from a Tyrannosaurus rex. Really? Soft tissue still after 65 million years? Schweitzer said that after removing the minerals from the specimen, the remaining tissues were soft and transparent and could be manipulated with instruments. This is a paleontologist telling us this. He's just saying, this is what I found. We broke open a T-Rex fossil. We found soft tissues. We got the minerals separated from these soft tissues, and we found that they were transparent, they were flexible, they were soft, and you could take instruments and move it around. You can't do that with stone, which is what most fossils are, but this was not stone. This was soft tissue from a T-Rex. The bone matrix was stretchy and flexible, she said. Also, there were large structures like blood vessels. What appeared to be individual cells were also visible. What other scientists are saying? John R. Horner of the Museum of the Rockies at Montana State University said, the discovery is a fantastic specimen, but probably not unique. Other researchers might find similarly preserved soft tissues if they split open the bones in their collections. And you can just imagine all these paleontologists, let's go down and break open all our fossils. Probably not. Maybe for a couple of reasons. Well, number one, that's a pretty good thing to have a fossil. You don't want to break it. Unless you think you might find something like this. What does this tell us? Is that bone 65 million years old? Are we being asked to believe that stretchy, flexible, transparent tissues have survived 70 million years without disintegrating? Okay, let's bring it down to 65. You can't believe 70 million? Let's do 65 million. I'm making fun. I shouldn't do that, but that's a lot of time. How did it survive? What science would provide a definitive explanation for that kind of preservation? In other words, can you explain this with science? Well, no, there's no way to take what we know and say, here's how soft tissues could survive 65 million years inside a fossil. It just doesn't work. So which demands more faith? 70 million year old soft tissues, or a more recent age for these remains? If you died in a flood, that would have been just a few thousand years ago, and it would be much easier to see how soft tissues could remain inside a fossilized bone. Got a conclusion? We've been told that dinosaurs became extinct millions of years ago with such consistency and fervor that we have come to accept this as science. It's just science. Believe it. If you don't believe it, you're stupid, you're dumb, you're backwards, you're uneducated, you're uninformed. But the abundance of evidence regarding the recent existence of dinosaurs leads us to conclude that a time frame of millions of years simply does not fit with what we see. When we see depictions of these animals, accurate depictions, with information about their depictions that we didn't know until the mid-90s, it leads us to the conclusion that people saw these animals and they made artwork. They drew them, they etched them, they carved them in stone, and they carved them in wood. They made pottery. They wrote about them. They passed down the stories. Very fascinating. So here's the behemoth, first of the ways of God. If you've got your Bible and you want to turn to Job chapter 40, this is where we'll read about the behemoth in 5 minutes. And what's going on here is, if you're familiar with the story of Job, he's been through quite a bit, and the temptation is to question God, and God says, no, you don't need to question me. I know what I'm doing. You need to put your faith in me, and here's why. Let me ask you some questions and see what you know. And I think probably all of us who have been parents have done this with our children. We our children get a little bit uppity and they think they know stuff, and so we have to put them in their place by asking them questions. Do you know how to do this? What do you know about this? How much money do you have? Where do you get your stuff? What did you wash your clothes today, or did your mom wash your clothes? These kind of questions to help people see and understand their status and their situation. That's what God was doing with Job. And if you count all the questions, there's about 72 of them that he asked Job. And Job had to go, oh, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, 72 times, I don't know. And God is trying to show him, as he's trying to show us when we read it, just trust me, just trust me. So, Job chapter 40, verse 15. Behold now, Behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now his strength in his loins and the power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. So of all the creatures God's made, this one's the first. He's the most biggest and magnificent, he says. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. There's this reference to water that's in the Bible that we seem to be seeing in the depictions that people have of these ancient creatures. The lotus plants cover him with shade. The willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He's confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he's on watch with barbs? Can anyone pierce his nose? That's the Behemoth. So God tells Job, behold, Behemoth, which I made as well as you. In other words, Genesis 6, when I made man, I made these creatures. He eats grass like an ox. His strength is in the loins, and the power is in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. So what animal in modern times can do that? Can you think of anything besides a sauropod dinosaur that has a tail like a cedar that he can bend? Nothing in modern times. His bones are like tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. And even if we went to the largest animals we have today, an elephant or a rhinoceros, people have been killing, capturing elephants and rhinos and large animals like that for centuries. But this is different, God says. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He cannot be captured. So this is the Behemoth that God is describing for Job. And then observations here. God had previously asked Job about at least 10 different animals with which we are also familiar, such as goats, deer, lions, oxen, donkeys, horses, ostriches, ox, hawks, eagles, and ravens. In other words, you see this in the text. He's asking Job about all these animals, and you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. He would have seen that. He would know about that. Then he gets to Behemoth. Well, hey, just imagine that. This is something out of fanciful. No. Job knew about the Behemoth. He saw it. That's why God is asking. You see that Behemoth? That's first of my ways. I made him when I made you. This is the way he, and you, let me point out some facts that you already know about him to show you. You don't know what you're doing, I do. The interrogation was based on the ideas that Job was familiar with these creatures, and even with the familiarity, with that familiarity, would have been able to unable to answer God's questions about them. So was God talking to Job, or asking him to observe what we're now calling an Apatosaurus or a Diplodocus? There's a couple of artist representations of those dinosaurs. What about the Leviathan? God assumed Job's familiar with this animal as well. This is from chapter 41. This animal could not be caught with hooks or bound with cords. Couldn't be made into merchandise. Can you make a crocodile into merchandise? Well, yeah, we know about that. People have been doing that for thousands of years too, but you can't do it with this animal. Couldn't be taken with any weapon, not any weapon that they had at that time. He had overwhelming strength, armored with scales, teeth inspired terror. Now, this is all from the description that God gives Job, and I'm sure Job is going, yeah, yeah, I've seen that thing. I know all about it. He sneezed fire and smoke. Wow. Oh, that couldn't have happened then because there's nothing alive we know about today that does that. Well, wait a minute. Yes, there is too. Feared by the mighty. Iron is like straw, bronze like rotten wood when you try to attack this creature. Made the deep to boil. And there's a picture of Spinosaurus, the apparent rival to Mr. T-Rex, the huge dinosaur we now know existed. Maybe that's him. So here's the Leviathan. We're talking about sneezing fire. Is that a possibility? The lowly bombardier beetle. He ranges in size from 2 millimeters to 30 millimeters. Pretty small. Produces hydroquinones and hydrogen peroxide. And these are mixed in a combustion chamber with a catalyst. You know what a catalyst is? That's a rancher. He expels hot gas at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is a little bug. And God made him with the capacity to create this 212 degree Fahrenheit gas that he could expel with a directional nozzle against his enemies. If God can do that with a little bug, what can he do with something the size of a dinosaur? Well, I can't believe we got through that today. So that's more evidence that, yeah, what the Bible says is true. He said he created everything in 6 days, and we've got the evidence that shows these animals that some say were extinct for 65 million years really were not that old. Thank you. Appreciate it. Class dismissed.